Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. We'll lead the program with politics today as opposition parties take aim at the controversial Dina Pule cabinet appointment as a GNU credibility test. The Road Accident Fund in crisis, but payouts are still coming. A new report says policy certainty, fresh capital and technology will ultimately decide who wins in the mining industry and why foreign nationals may need more than legal paperwork as South Africa's immigration crisis hardens. It's Thursday, the 2nd of July. President Ramaphosa's decision to appoint Dina Pule as Minister of Social Development has triggered a fierce backlash from opposition parties and civil society, with critics pointing to previous findings of improper and unethical conduct during her time as the Communications Minister. Action SA has called the reshuffle proof that the Government of National Unity is protecting political insiders rather than driving accountability. Tough words. Let's talk now to Athol Trollope, who is Action SA's parliamentary leader. Athol, Dina Pule's appointment, is it simply a bad one, or does it tell us something deeper about the GNU?
Jeremy, look, I must right up front say that I have not known Dina Pule for very long, but I have served in the agriculture portfolio where she has been the chairperson for the last 2 years. And I believe that she did a fairly good job in that capacity. But she does have a checkered background. And this is our concern as Action SA, because it appears that the ANC barrel is completely empty. And, you know, if they're battling to find a suitable replacement for the Minister of Social Development, imagine their dilemma in a year or two's time when they need to replace their president. I mean, they've had a really, really poor president in Cyril Ramaphosa, but, you know, God knows where they're going to find a replacement, because it just appears that they do not have suitable people. So let's get closer to Dina Pule and the Department of Social Development. I read an article this morning that I'm sure you might have read as well about the kind of people that have been heading up that department, including, you know, Sisi Tolashe, who's just been fired, and Matabile Dlamini Zuma, who infamously told us that everyone in the ANC has small and young skeletons. These are all people that have come out of the ANC Women's League, and it appears that this particular department is the sole preserve of somebody from the ANC Women's League. Now, that really bothers me, Jeremy, because, you know, women are supposed to be caring, compassionate people. And if you come from a women's organization, you would think that that is what you, kind of person you would be. But if you ask any of the 20-odd million social grant recipients in this country whether they experience care and compassion on a daily basis from this department, and I would venture, you wouldn't find any. So really, we are very, very perplexed and concerned as Action SA that this is the very best that the ANC have to offer.
Athol Trollope, let me ask you this question. In your opinion, is there any room in public life then for political rehabilitation, or is sometimes there are specific ethics breaches that are permanently disqualifying?
Well, let me just tell you, Jeremy, we've got a dilemma in our parliament where we keep having this debate about, you know, fit and proper people. Most recently, we were trying to establish in this committee that has been set up, the impeachment committee, to consider possible impeachment of the president. And there was an endeavor to define what kind of people we wanted to serve on that committee, and that there was an endeavor to say you must be fit and proper. And it was pushed back tremendously, because some political parties have people who are represented amongst their ranks that have got either criminal records or have been implicated in wrongdoing, in corruption, or have been impeached. And it's a problem, because the barrier to entry into parliament is that you must not have been found guilty of a criminal offence and been charged a sentence of more than a year, or not be unrehabilitated insolvent. Now, that leaves the rest open, and unfortunately, our representation in Parliament is very short when it comes to fit and proper, and I mean, I say that with respect, I'm also a member of Parliament. But it appears that, you know, rehabilitation is one thing. If you're rehabilitated, you must have gone through a rehabilitation process. But that doesn't appear to apply in the ANC. You simply get retreaded. And there's a big difference between rehabilitation and being retreaded.
Let me ask you about social development specifically, Athol Trollip. It controls grants and serves millions of vulnerable South Africans, as you've indicated. What do you think the real risk is if public trust in that ministry is damaged?
Well, look, we've seen in the most recent past, Minister and others, they have used this department as, I don't know, as a trough to feed from ANC ministers. Now, if the department that is there to service the most needy in our country, and there are too many people that are living below the breadline that are desperate for social grants, if that is being used as a trough, either for personal gain or party political gain, then there's a big problem in this country. My concern, though, is you can go to any SASSA grant pay per point, and you will find people, elderly women and men, who've been spending the night on the street waiting for the SASSA office to open so that they can access services, payments that weren't made on time, etc. Recently, President Mashaba of Action SA was in Soweto at the Maponya Mall, and there were hundreds of people who'd camped out the whole night in blankets on the side of the street, right, waiting for the offices to open. So we don't see much care and compassion coming out of the Department of Social Development, and we would like to see somebody that has a long track record in that kind of service to be appointed as the minister.
Athol Trollip, let's stay with the cabinet reshuffle, but your party has also attacked the move of John Steenhuisen to deputy minister. Is your argument that deputy ministry or ministries have now simply become political shock absorbers?
Well, our argument is very clear in that I personally moved a constitutional amendment to do away with deputy ministers entirely. You know, I'll give you one example why. When the Minister of Police was placed on gardening leave, and he's still there, instead of using or promoting one of the deputy ministers to be a caretaker minister, we had to go and find somebody outside of Parliament in Feroz Khachalia to be the acting minister. And there's no provision for an acting minister in the Constitution. So this is all very peculiar. When it comes to John Steenhuisen, if he was removed by his party solely for his mismanagement of the foot and mouth disease outbreak, which is what Jordan Hill Lewis said he did, then why should he be redirected to being a deputy minister elsewhere? If he's failed as a minister, surely that is failure enough to be removed entirely. But we've seen that it is a shock absorber. It is a position of patronage where somebody fails in a senior role of responsibility, is then redirected to a slightly junior role, but still very, very well remunerated. And it's a position, it's a mattress. I mean, former DA member Dion George says that he's been bounced out of the ministry into a deputy minister position and a nice comfy mattress to catch his fall. And that to us is unacceptable because it's paid for from the public purse. So why are we protecting people with the public purse, protecting politicians that have failed with the public purse?
Athol Trollip is the parliamentary leader for the political party Action SA.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Road Accident Fund is under growing financial and political pressure, with a reported 40 billion rand unfunded claims liability and a widening annual deficit. And that has been well documented. But I understand that accident victims are still receiving substantial compensation, in some cases running into multi-million rand payouts, including recent rewards of more than 9 million rand. So one's got to ask the question, is this a broken system or still a vital lifeline for injured South Africans, albeit an organization that is facing difficulties? Someone who has a view on that is Chris Smit, who is a partner at DSC Attorneys. Chris, welcome to you. So if the RAF is sitting with 40 billion rand in unfunded claims liability, why should an injured person still believe the system can pay them? There seems to be a disconnect here.
Jeremy, yes, that's a very good question. Look, the Road Accident Fund is still obliged to compensate people despite the financial position that they're finding themselves in. And the positive side on that is that there is a continued inflow, continued funding to the Road Accident Fund from government, and that, of course, from the levy on the fuel price. So, yes, there is money, and yes, there is this big deficit, but the Road Accident Fund is still paying out valid claims.
Surely at some point, though, something has got to alter in that balance, and things could go horribly wrong.
Well, hopefully not. You know, the system is definitely faulted, as you pointed out, but it is working. It is working slowly, and there's a definite attempt to fix the problems in the Road Accident Fund. And that is, of course, something that we all support.
These multi-million rand payouts, Chris, that I referenced, is that real proof that the RAF is actually working effectively, or are we just talking about rare headline cases here?
Look, those cases that you mentioned, the million rand cases, are definitely headline because of the huge quantum involved. The Road Accident Fund is paying out, but you can also take into consideration that not all claims are that big. So the Road Accident Fund is functioning, albeit it's functioning, but you know, definitely not at 100% as the way it should be.
But I guess the public danger here is that people hear, as you and I are discussing, millions, and maybe develop unrealistic expectations about not only their own claim, but the time it's going to take to settle it.
That is correct. You know, a lot of people approach attorneys, and we see a lot of programs on TV, especially the American programs, where there's a totally different type of compensation, and they do expect millions. Like I said, these huge million rand claim payouts are normally in cases of severe injuries with cognitive deficits and you know, paralysis and lifelong injuries. So they are definitely the exceptions, but that doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile proceeding with your claim, you know, even if it's not a million rand claim.
As someone who deals then with the RAF, what do you think needs immediate fixing here?
That's a long and complicated question, but definitely the management system. Look, at the moment, the Road Accident Fund is totally understaffed, which I think is a huge problem. The claims handlers sometimes sit with 1,000 files that they need to deal with, which is, from a practical aspect, not realistic. And then there's the further burden on the state attorneys that have to now deal with these matters after the Road Accident Fund decided to disband the system where they used panel attorneys.
Let's talk a little bit about panel attorneys. If I understand this correctly, and as you say, it's a fairly complicated issue, the fund stopped using panel attorneys, as I get it, to cut costs. Has that made the claims process more chaotic?
Yes and no. At some stage, the fund stopped using the panel attorneys, and the instruction was then for the claims handlers to deal with these claims themselves. And because they were unable, that already created a backlog. It was then decided that these claims would now be administered by the state attorneys, and the state attorneys already had a full plate, now had to deal with these extra Road Accident Fund matters. They have started appointing more and more attorneys to assist them, but that created a huge backlog to the backlog that they already had.
The claimant him or herself, how, and this is a question, I guess, about process and whether the issue is of a judicious nature or not. How does the claimant know whether a settlement offer is fair or whether they are being shortchanged when it comes to the value of what they are given?
Quantifying a claim is quite a complicated issue. So I don't think anyone would really appreciate it. And an award made by the Road Accident Fund without consulting with a specialist attorney, at least to get an opinion on whether it's a good claim or not. It's the same as, you know, buying or selling your car. You're not going to sell it for price if you haven't verified what it's worth. And there are different heads of damages. There are different categories that people qualify for when claiming from the Road Accident Fund. And each of these categories, we call it heads of damages, need to be investigated separately and quantified by a specialist. So if the Road Accident Fund simply makes you an offer for 100,000 Rand or 500,000 Rand, you would not be in a position to know whether that is a reasonable and fair settlement.
And Chris, tell me, what is the quality then of that specialist investigative capacity? For instance, how much would fault matter could someone still claim if they were partly responsible for the crash, for instance? How difficult is it to determine that?
That is an element that affects how big a claim is. So if you contributed to an accident which contributed to your own injuries, it doesn't mean that you don't have a claim, but the courts in the Right Accident Fund will look at contributory negligence, and that will be apportioned accordingly. So, for example, if the Road Accident Fund or the court finds that you contributed 50% to an accident, it means that your claim will be reduced by 50%. But it doesn't mean that you don't have a claim. Only if you, the sole cause of the injuries, if you're 100% negligent, then you won't be able to claim from the Road Accident Fund. But that's a factual determination based on the facts.
And as a motorist, what do I need to understand about the process, if you can answer that? For instance, what is the biggest mistake an accident victim can make, maybe in the first week or weeks after a crash, that might damage their claim later?
Well, it often happens that you're involved in an accident and you think you're not seriously injured and you just leave it. But it's important to note that all accidents where there's an injury involved has to be reported. So one of the requirements for lodging a claim with the Road Accident Fund is that the accident must be reported. So it's important to get the details, get details of witnesses, and to seek medical attention, even if there's just the slightest worry. You know, it might be nothing, but injuries could develop later on, and then there's a problem that you don't have any record or details of any witnesses and details of the accident.
Thank you very much for talking to me. That's Chris Smith, who is a partner at DSC Attorneys.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The global mining industry has had a strong financial year, but PwC says the next phase is going to be a whole lot harder. Its latest Mine 2026 Ambition to Action report shows the world's top 40 mining companies lifted revenue to around $900 billion and a net profit of $120 billion in 2025. But the industry is facing tougher questions around geopolitics, around critical minerals, capital shortages, policy certainty and technology adoption. So let's pull all of that together. I'm in conversation now with Vuyiswa Kutlang, who is Energy Utilities and Resource Assurance Partner at PwC. Vuyiswa, a very warm welcome to you. So if the top 40 miners are making strong profits, why is there a warning that the industry still has to move from ambition to action?
The warning, Jeremy, arises from the fact that mining is a long-term industry and very capital intensive. So one needs to look and invest now for what you want to reap later. And when we have look at the report that we've done, we see that, for example, with the energy-related industries, we've got a $3.3 trillion investment in capital. But what we're only seeing being allocated to mining is $55 billion. And that's strange if you think about it, because all these key industries, the solar panels, where everybody's focusing, the batteries, everything that we say we're going to need in the future needs critical minerals, and critical minerals sit in mining. So we need to be investing in mining right now to be able to reap the benefits later. So that gap tells us that there is a problem going forward.
Do you think mining companies are only financially strong right now because they're more efficient, or simply because, and let's be honest, there's been a really good run in terms of commodity prices?
I think it's a combination of both, Jeremy. So we've seen, and really that's what mining companies have to do. Costs are more relatively quite fixed, majority of them. So they have to be as lean as possible to be able to survive downtimes. But definitely what we've seen with prices, especially with precious metals, has done wonders for the mining companies, and hence these profits, these revenues, and this kind of returning to shareholders that we're seeing in the last couple of years.
You mentioned critical minerals, which we know are central to energy transition. Do you think mining companies are moving quickly enough to meet this demand, or at least are planning in that respect to meet it at some point?
Definitely, they are, because when you look at the deals that are taking place at the moment, really what you see is gold and then these critical minerals. So your lithium, your copper, all of those minerals are the focus of deals that are happening now. So the mining companies are moving there. They're having these deals. The problem is the investment. Are they getting capital to be able to take these from exploration phase to production phase? And that's where the tricky part is. And also even exploration, mining, like I said before, is a long-term view type of industry that you have. So getting capital to be able to explore, which is quite expensive, is difficult. So looking at all the risks that sit within the mining industry, will you get your permits? Are you protected? What laws are in that country going forward? Is critical in ensuring that we get more capital, because the risk that you have is higher than most industries just because of the amount of stakeholders involved, the legislation involved, and I guess the term, how long it takes to be able to have positive returns.
So what now determines whether a country captures that mining value that you're talking about? You're suggesting that pure geology is no longer enough.
It becomes those things that attract investment. So what laws do you have? The legislation that you have? What benefits your funding that you are offering? So a lot of these other countries, for example, have funds that they're giving mining companies to be able to tap into. So you come in to explore, here's a fund for you that you can get access to. Tax benefits are some of the other things that other countries are putting in place. So you've got all this huge capital expenditure that you'll get while we start giving you deductions quite early, or big incentives to be able to come mine here. The other things are things like that, for example, South Africa has been focusing on your mineral rights. Am I secure in my mineral rights? So we know in South Africa, the department has been focusing on that and has rolled it out in the Western Cape. We are waiting to see what happens in other provinces and the results of the Western Cape, the Cadaldro system. Things like that are what will take us forward. Energy security, I mean, a big thing in South Africa, we have all these smelters saying that they're going to be shutting down. Energy is too expensive. Now, that's a value add. And we're saying in South Africa, we don't want to be sending out unprocessed minerals, or we want to send it as towards 99%, closer towards 99%. So those things become critical in being able to say, well, I'm attracting investment. All the risks that you're identifying in terms of mining, hey, as a country, I've looked at it, and here's how I'm addressing it.
I'm assuming your argument, therefore, is predicated on a new type of financing model that would be needed to unlock new mines and processing capacity.
It is a new financing model, and we've seen how the financing models have transitioned over the years, right? Looking at different scenarios that these mining companies, we've had people come in where, for example, they have financing until a certain level. You've got financing where, for instance, you will deliver the commodity. So this is very popular with gold mining companies, where I'm financing you, but whatever you produce comes to me for a certain amount of years. Other ones that we've seen come in is where your financing is backed, for example, by the government. So that reduces, if you are at default, the risk is reduced because you've got the backing of the state. So we've seen very creative financing arrangements being done to enable that the industry to get access to capital to ensure that projects come forward. But again, it's those other risks that are coming in and saying, well, how are we managing as a country those other risks to ensure that your venture capitalist, your private equity, when I go out into the market and I say, please invest, that those people can see that the risk is not as high, or the return allows for them to be able to invest. Because the riskier your asset is, the more you return you want. And that's the problem, because when you see other projects out there, the return you require is less. So therefore, you will go there.
And just a final question and a quick answer. I found it very interesting when you said that mining ranks low when it comes to readiness as far as artificial intelligence is concerned. You've got to wonder why such a capital-intensive industry is behind on this technology.
I think the problem is that the mining systems have been quite fragmented. And that's one of the biggest issues that they've got. So you've got your system that you're using underground, your system that you're using for your stores. All of those can have been fragmented. And I think bringing it all together, getting it all on one system, getting data that is reliable, that you can make decision based on, becomes critical. And those are the steps I think mining companies will have to take to ensure that when they adopt AI, because you can adopt, but the problem is the data also.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Vuyiswa Kutlang, who's Energy Utilities and Resource Assurance Partner at PwC South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's immigration debate has entered a sharper and more dangerous phase, with lawful foreign nationals increasingly worried that having a valid visa may not be enough when public pressure, workplace scrutiny and enforcement action collide. So what should migrants, employers and families do before their status is challenged? I want to talk about that with Roxana Naidu, who's Director of Global Strategy at the advisory firm Latita Africa. Welcome back to the program, and as I understand it, your central argument is that legal does not always mean safe. What do you mean by that?
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy. And yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I've had an influx of clients, I think, for the past few weeks now, where, yes, they already have their paperwork, or they are foreign nationals that are waiting with pending applications, and they are in South Africa legally. The problem right now is that having that defensible paper trail isn't that easily accessible for many people. Either they don't have the proper documentation because it's pending right now, or they've lost documentation or don't know where they can find that. And when we are at a stage where we are right now in South Africa, where this is being questioned to every single foreign national, you need to make sure that you have that defensible paper trail to prove that, whether you're stopped by law enforcement or whether you are questioned by an employer.
And of great concern that if someone has a valid visa, they still feel exposed in the current climate. And I would imagine that fear or concern exacerbated by the protests that we have seen this past week.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think a lot of people are concerned that if they're not able to produce valid paperwork, you know, what are the consequences for that? And right now, I'm trying to get the immigrants that I'm working with in a space where they're able to verify their status. So if your application is pending, you should be able to show proof of that process immediately. It's not something where you can say, oh, hold on, let me go and find it. That means having copies of your previous or your current visas. It means you need to have the renewal, or if you're appealing the process, you need to have proof of that, or even your VFS receipts and any type of acknowledgement from Home Affairs. It's not enough to just say, I have my papers. That proof needs to exist.
And I think the key word there, which is worth exploring, might be pending. Is a pending visa, a waiver or an appeal application enough protection in this current climate? Or do you think, Roxana, people can still get into trouble?
So that's the thing, Jeremy. In practice, many foreign nationals, they're not ignoring the law. They've submitted the applications, they've followed the process, and they're still waiting for a decision. So the challenge is that delay creates a gray area in daily life for a foreign national. So a person may have done the right thing, but they are now still struggling with an employer, with a bank or a landlord or a school, or even some official that has asked questions, just because they can't immediately prove where they stand and what their status is. So that's why I always distinguish between the status and then the evidence that can actually prove that.
And it's immediate proof, which I think is critical. You also suggest that a person's story matters less than their documents, right?
Absolutely. For a foreign national, that would usually include, again, it's going to be your valid passport, your current visa or permit, your proof of any renewal, travel documents that you have. It's a file that you need to have with all of that paperwork that tells the story, not simply being able to vocalize that, but evidence with the dates, with the stamps that can be handed over to an official or anyone that would request that from you.
You also warn that a visa solution is not always a tax solution. How can someone be lawful then with Home Affairs, but also be exposed to the South African Revenue Service?
Okay, so what the foreign national living in South Africa needs to remember is that SARS confirms that South Africa uses a residence-based tax system. So that means that residents are generally taxed on their worldwide income. but non-residents are taxed on their South African sourced income, so income earned in South Africa. So that means now that your remote workers, executives, consultants, business owners that are now working in South Africa, that are foreign nationals, they should not assume that that visa solution is the same as the tax solution. Just because they have a visa in South Africa, it does not negate the tax obligations that they have. They also need to look at the double taxation agreements between South Africa and their country of origin, to see where those tax implications lie.
I just want to ask you two quick questions about risk, if I can. The first is, what could happen to a company if it gets the workers' visa conditions, payroll treatment, or the right to work status wrong? There's obviously a penalty here.
So, yes, there are legal exposures that can be quite serious. Under the Immigration Act specifically, employers may not employ an illegal foreigner or a foreigner whose status does not authorize employment by that employer, or a person who is working outside the terms of that status. So the risk is evidentiary. If an illegal foreigner is found on a business premises, there can be a presumption that the person was employed by the person in control of that premises, unless there's evidence to the contrary. So the issue is not only the employee's immigration status, it's also whether the employer can prove that it took reasonable steps as well.
And finally, Roxanne, with community groups and neighbours sometimes demanding documents, as has been evidenced this week, is there a legal line between public concern and intimidation?
Absolutely. And I think it's necessary to understand that public anger doesn't create legal authority in any way. You have private individuals, landlords, neighbors, community groups, informal movements. They do not become immigration officials, and you do not owe them any type of paperwork unless lawfully required. Police and authorized officials may have powers in proper circumstances, but unauthorized demands, threats for document seizures, those types of things, it's not necessary for immigration enforcement. You need proper legal and safety mechanisms for this. So foreign nationals should avoid treating, you know, these types of arguments, these social arguments. They need to keep their original documents safe. Don't just hand it out to anyone. And use certified or digital copies of documents where appropriate. You know, you don't want to be handing over to the wrong person.
Roxana Naidu, Director of Global Strategy at the advisory firm Latita Africa, thank you very much. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.